This episode of Travel Today with Peter Greenberg is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Sign up today at www.audiblepodcast.com/travel today to get a free audiobook and 30-day trial.
It's time for Peter Greenberg Worldwide with America's number one travel news journalist. And now, the man who travels over 400,000 miles each year, your travel detective, Peter Greenberg.
Hi, everybody. Peter Greenberg here, and welcome to the podcast that's done from a different location around the world every single week. One day Canada, the next day Thailand, then New York, London. You just never know. This week we come to you from Anaheim, California, which is a whole lot more than Disneyland, trust me. It's Roger Dowd, President and CEO of the U.S. Travel Association, the 51st Annual International Powwow, IPW, which we'll explain in a second. I've been coming to many of them. We actually broadcast from the IPW last year in Denver, and the year before that, I believe it was in
Washington D.C. For the first time.
That's right. And here it is in Anaheim at the Convention Center. Roger, I want to start off by just posing a theory here, that when you ask people what is a foreign export, they'll tell you, well, steel, okay, or automobiles, or corn, wheat, textiles. I mean, you can go through the whole list of what the United States exports, but people never put travel on that list. And travel is a huge foreign export.
Yeah, an export is anytime someone from outside the company, outside our country, buys an American product. And travel is an American product. So when people come from Germany or China, Japan, Australia to visit here, it's the same as them buying a computer or buying one of our farm goods. So it's an export. It's a big export, $250 billion a year.
And you know, this is, and not to mention the jobs it creates, which we'll get to in a second, but you've had a challenge since the day of USTA's beginning to educate legislators, to educate policymakers, to educate municipal and state governments, and now to educate the public as to the power of travel and tourism and how it relates to their lives. Now more than ever, I would suspect, with trade wars starting and tariffs being implemented, which most people don't understand or don't know where the money's going or where it comes from, a tariff, you know, impacts the price of steel. It impacts the price of an avocado. It impacts the price of a car. It impacts the price and the cost of travel.
Exactly. And it's and whenever you get into these trade wars and these discussions, we say travel is trade. And the challenge we have is there's unintended consequences that bleed over beyond steel, beyond aluminum, beyond agriculture products to things like travel.
And, you know, if President Trump, he's already basically in a trade war with China. He's on the verge of one again with Mexico. But we've seen already a drop in foreign arrivals for the last 2 years anyway, mostly from Europe. Now it's coming from Asia.
Yeah, what's happening is not only China but South Korea are both softening, and we enjoy 3.2 million visitors from China who are the largest spenders. So when
By the way, when you mentioned largest spenders, I'm going to stagger. I mean, you know the answer to this, but I stagger my friends with it all the time. An American on a week-long vacation might spend $1,500, right, maybe $2,000. What do the Chinese spend in a week?
The average international traveler spends $4,400. The average Chinese spends over $7,000 per person per trip.
So now let's. You don't have to be a math whiz, and by the way, I'm not, to run the numbers to realize how staggering this is if you don't have it.
When you look at the talk about trade and trade deficits and trade surplus, we've got a $69 billion travel trade surplus, meaning more people outside the United States spend money here than Americans spend there.
And we want that.
We want that. And to China, a $31 billion trade surplus. So half of our trade surplus in travel comes from China.
So the minute you start messing with the gods on other products and services, the reaction is almost inevitable. It's reciprocity.
We saw that happen when several years ago China was in a tiff with South Korea, and they put out the word, don't go to South Korea. The next day, no one went to South Korea.
And then?
And then the billions it cost. And the bottom line is our big concern. Now, both governments see the tremendous value from travel back and forth. So we're hoping we don't get caught up in this. But as I say, there's unintended consequences when these things get started.
I think we already caught up in it because the number of Chinese to the United States is dropping.
We are seeing that. We're seeing a drop in business travel, major drop in government travel of government officials from China coming, and also in meetings and conventions, people coming from China. So we're starting to see it there. Leisure's still holding its own, but those areas.
You know, it's interesting to look at it another way, and most people don't connect these dots. I'm beginning to. When the Chinese, and I'm not singling them out, but just to use them as an example here, when they travel to Honolulu, Los Angeles, New York, large international gateway cities, they're on a shopping spree. I know this for a fact because when I'm in Europe and I buy a product where I'm not going to get my value-added tax back, I have to go stand in a line at customs before I board my flight. That line is as long as Brazil, and I'm the only person who's not Chinese in that line. They have bought everything. And now I take a look at, if you took a walk with me, and I'm not saying this is a direct relationship, but I think there is a relationship here. If you take a walk with me from 59th Street on Madison Avenue up to 86th Street on Madison Avenue in New York, every third store is vacant. It's the death of retail. But those stores are flagship stores of name brands that didn't exist for the locals in New York to buy. They really existed for the visitors to buy.
I had, and I will not mention the name, but one of the largest upscale stores in New York tell me without the visitors from outside the United States, he'd have to close his doors. 55% of all his profits come from visitors.
Right. So everybody's in on this, except they don't know they're in on it.
Right.
Right?
Exactly.
So what's the solution?
The solution is many things. To really increase the number of visas that we have, the number of people we interview, to get more technology, and we've got to get the word across. We've shared this with the president. We're all for security. Without security, there is no travel. But we also have to have a welcoming message. The president should be stepping forward, as everyone should be, saying, no bad guys, but we want all the good guys here.
Right, but that message isn't being said.
It's not being said, and we try as an industry to say that as much as we can. That's what we're doing here at IPW. But the bottom line, it could be a tremendous boon to jobs, to our economy, just with that simple message.
And now let's talk about IPW, because you see it here up close and personal. You have 6,000 plus people here, right? These are buyers.
We have 6,000 people from 70 countries around the world. We'll do 110,000 20-minute appointments, and the next 3 days, they'll contract or negotiate about $5 billion of future travel to the United States.
To the United States?
To the United States.
This isn't about Mrs. Schmidlap going to France.
No.
Right.
This is, they're sitting down tomorrow in these days with Disney and saying, I'm from Germany, what if I buy 10,000 tickets next year? They're sitting down with Marriott or Hilton saying, I want 50 rooms a night in the following cities every single night.
So obviously we still want them and we're still catering to them, but is it a buyer's market now for them?
It is. It's beginning part of that. And the other thing that no one thinks about is it's our stealth public diplomacy. We've done all sorts of research. When people come to the United States, they return home 75% positive about America, American policy. Those that aren't are about 20%. So what better way to build our standing around the world than have more people come here?
Right. And the 20% that didn't have a good time, they were caught in a speed trap in rural Georgia.
I think that was it.
By the same cop in the same small town.
Yes.
With the same crooked judge. I got it. So when you're talking to legislators, we're talking to congressmen and senators, congresswomen and senators, what message are you telling them, and are they getting it?
Some get it. The message I'm telling them, this is how you employ people. Of all the jobs that were created, and a lot of talk about created jobs and low unemployment. Of all the jobs that were created last year, almost 25% were created by the travel industry, and we're only 3% of the GDP. So we're creating jobs at eight times the size of the industry.
And, of course, if you look at the World Travel and Tourism Council statistics, they will tell you that travel and tourism is somewhere on an average of about nearly 11% of global GDP.
Right.
That's staggering.
And it's huge, and yet that doesn't even count. If you take transportation, the huge part of the GDP, what do you think's in transportation? All those Boeing planes. So it goes way beyond just, I just talked about travel being $2.5 trillion, but think about the Boeing planes. Think about the other things we don't even think about with travel.
Well, interesting you mentioned that, because if you look at every American president since Kennedy, they were de facto ambassadors for Boeing because they're our biggest exporter. Right? I mean, those planes are a lot of money.
Well, absolutely.
And when there were trade missions going overseas and the president was part of that in many cases, their biggest flag that they were flying was by Boeing.
There's no question about it.
I know. And what's interesting now is it wasn't just particular to Obama or Clinton or anybody. It was every president. And then when the U.S. airlines were screaming and yelling about our trade deal with Iran, or they were screaming and yelling about Qatar to Trump, Trump's response was, yeah, but they buy a lot of Boeing airplanes.
Well, and the bottom line is, you talk about all the presidents and folks pushing Boeing planes. If they push travel, it's much bigger by a factor of many than Boeing. And it's easier because everything's built. All the hotels, the airports, they're all built.
Right, but what you're talking about is a concept versus a product.
Yeah.
And that's what people can't get their, literally mm-hmm. can't get their arms around.
Right.
All right, let's go from trade tariffs to real pocketbook issues here. What I've seen this year, which is sort of refreshing, is airfares have not spiked. In fact, in many cases, they've gone down. Do you see that continuing, Roger?
I think we're going to see it continue. What keeps me up at night is thinking about, on these trade wars, if we begin seeing fewer people coming from outside the United States, whether it be China, Mexico, places like that. We've, in the hotel business and travel business, had 120 straight months of growth. 120 straight months. Things don't go on forever. So my concern is, I think you're going to see a flattening, which is going to be more available rooms, which leads to prices going down. So I think probably you're not going to see big price increases, probably flat, and maybe in some cases some more bargains.
You know, you talk about 120 months of straight growth. Let's add this number in. Hilton is opening up one new hotel a day,
mm-hmm.
Not just in this country, but worldwide. Marriott's opening up one new hotel every 14 hours. It's staggering. So when you're opening at that rate, there might be in the short term a lot of owners that are happy because they now can have a Marriott-flagged hotel or a Hilton-flagged hotel. But now you got to fill the rooms. And that's a lot of rooms to fill. So if you're looking at a hotel occupancy anywhere above 68%, which for many hotels is their break-even, you start coming down from that. You got problems. You have consolidation.
Yeah, I think what's happening, you're seeing that growth, and everyone did their planning and their performance at the same time 3 years ago and said, wow, there's a great opportunity. Let's build this hotel. And I think you're going to see a lot of hotels open as a market is perhaps flattening out or going the other way.
Which brings up the other question that I keep asking. Are companies like Hilton and Marriott hotel companies, or are they real estate developers? Because I don't understand the business model anymore. Most people think that a Hilton hotel is owned by Hilton. It's not.
No.
They have equity in maybe 3 or 4 of their hotels, and they've got 4 or 5,000 hotels. Marriott's got over 7,000, of which they might have equity in 10 of them. That's not really their business. Their business is to build hotels for someone else that then let them manage it, and they get a percentage of that.
Right. No, they're basically a management company and a real estate company.
And more these days of a real estate company, yeah. I would think. And now Marriott's saying they're going to go head-to-head with Airbnb.
It's very interesting because you've watched the hotel industry be extraordinarily opposed to Airbnb, but yet now we're starting to see them one by one thinking about opening their own version of Airbnb with the promise of better quality, better controls.
Well, people like that idea, but you have to understand, which is another staggering figure, that Airbnb now controls 8% of the global room inventory. That's a lot of rooms.
I was talking to the head of Puerto Rico, and he was telling me the big comeback they're having, which is
right.
Great. But they had 11,000 hotel rooms, and a couple of years ago they had 2,000 Airbnb rooms. They now have 6,000 Airbnb rooms.
So just people need to make some money.
Factor of three,
right.
Airbnb has grown, and it's a way people are making money.
Exactly. You know, and I don't think governments are going to do very well at controlling them unless all the Airbnbs are in one high rise building. Then they can go after the owners. But if you have 6,000 individual Airbnbs in San Juan or throughout Puerto Rico, how do you police that? You don't.
No, it's a challenge. And it's been a game changer. It's the same as Uber, Lyft, whatever. It's been a game changer. And I think an industry has looked at it and said, you know, if we fight them enough, they'll go away. They're not going away.
I know. And then there's the other issue about how people make their room reservations. The online travel agencies, the OTAs, basically came into play because hotels were in trouble financially, and the OTAs came to them, the Expedias, the Travelocities, the Orbitzes, and said, hey, look, let us sell your unsold rooms. We'll make a little markup here, but at least you'll get something. And the hotels said, okay. And before the hotels knew it, they were selling all their rooms. And the owners of those hotels would go back to these management companies like Hilton and Marriott and say, wait a minute, you have a website. Why can't people book with you? And why do we have to pay up to 30% commission to these OTAs? And that's when Hilton started that campaign, stop clicking around and blah, blah, blah. I don't know if it's had an impact.
Well, I think the challenge is the horse is way out of the barn. And the traveling public has been trained to go to an OTA and look at all possibilities. And if you look at their commercials versus just one brand. And so the public is saying it might be quicker and easier that way.
Plus, if you take a look at what Hilton's trying to do, they say, if you go to our website, we'll give you a free bottle of water. We won't charge you for the Wi-Fi. I mean, they're giving people things that can actually have a tangible value to them. But not everybody's going to get that message right away because they've been trained, as you said, Roger, to just go online to the OTAs.
Yeah, and distribution is king. Whoever has distribution controls the industry.
Which means, again, hotel prices, or at least hotel profits, may be going down if they can't get that piece of the pie.
Right.
So what's the answer? Consolidation?
Well, if you look at, there's been a tremendous amount of consolidation going on. You talked about Marriott, Hilton, chains buying chains. What I look at now is the number of brands. Marriott has 32 brands right now. Hilton's approaching 20. And
by the way, I challenge anybody
between them.
And I challenge anybody listening to the show, unless you happen to work for Marriott, to name those 32 brands.
Yeah.
You can't do it. I mean, I was at a meeting once of travel industry professionals, and I asked them, this is about the time that Marriott bought Starwood. I said, okay, who here can name all the brands at Marriott? And one person raised their hand. I said, and who might you work for? He said, Marriott. I said, okay, fine. Go ahead, name them. And he did, and got applause. Wait, we're not done yet. Now can you differentiate?
Should there be a rapid change in cabin pressure, oxygen masks will automatically drop from the compartment above your seat, free of charge. And to start the flow of oxygen, pay your flight attendant $75.63. My mother, God rest
her soul. Joining me now is one of our regulars on the show. I know him as Johnny Descalda, but you know him as Johnny Jet. And every time we have him on the show, we talk about websites you've never heard about, applications you need to have, and every once in a while, websites you don't want to hear about and applications you never want to have when it comes to travel. So, Johnny, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
What's on your list today?
Well, you know, when I travel is usually the one time I use my alarm. I try not to use my alarm at home because I'm always.
But you use your alarm on your iPhone, I guess.
I do, but when I wake up to that alarm, my heart just starts beating really fast. It's just so rude and abrupt. So there's
what do you have now? Somebody whispering? What?
This one's called Dawn Chorus, D-A-W-N Chorus, and it's developed by the Carnegie Museum of Natural History and Innovation Studios. And what they do is they give you 20 northeastern birds to choose from. And actually, you can choose up to 5, and it sings a little song. And you wake
See,
up
now,
to birds.
If I want to wake up, I want a bird that's you know, wah! I don't want a bird going, good morning, good morning. I never get up.
No. Well, this is just really light and smooth. Actually,
Which bird did you pick?
Well, there's actually a blue jay, which is not that great of a sound, but there's a Baltimore Oriole.
Uh-huh.
Can you hear that?
That's going to wake you up?
How about that one?
Are you serious?
Yes. But as a backup.
Hold on. This is the app you came to me with today?
Yes, Dawn Chorus. It's popular. It's free. And you can always set your backup on your iPhone or Android, whatever you have. That way, to make sure this one
doesn't wake you up. See, what gets me up is not a little blue jay. It's Godzilla.
Well, my dad is legally deaf, and I got him an alarm called the Atomic Bomb. And it vibrates.
Oh, geez.
It vibrates underneath his pillow. The whole bed shakes. I mean, that is something.
Wait a minute. I want that.
Yeah. It's like $20. I bought it on Amazon.
It's called Atomic Bomb?
I think it's called the Atomic Bomb Alarm. It's been a couple of years.
Wow.
Actually, I'll give you his because he doesn't even use it.
I'll take it. Okay.
And you just hook it up to your phone and you set the alarm via your phone.
You're never going to oversleep that one.
You'll never oversleep that one for
You'll
sure.
You'll be cowering under the covers.
No. Okay. It's an amazing one.
All right. So that's one.
Okay. How about New York City? They have 3,600 Link New York City. You know those digital signs that, you know, been in the news because homeless people are watching porn on them or charging their phones and things like that.
Yeah.
Well, there's a new app.
Like at bus stops and stuff like that.
No, it's just right on the streets of New York City.
That's what I'm saying. Those little bus stations.
Yeah,
yeah. Those,
yeah. And so anyway, there's a new app called Shoutable. And what you can do is you can post a message on there for one minute. I did it a couple weeks ago when I was in New York with my wife. Freaked her out. It said, hey, Natalie, you rock. Love, Jack, our son. She's like, how'd you do that? Anyway.
What is this? Override the system?
They developed it with it, I guess, to make some money. Because the first one's free, and then it's $4.95 per shoutable.
That's expensive. How long does it last on the sign?
60 seconds.
Oh, so it's long enough for you to take a stupid picture.
Exactly.
Thank you.
But
okay.
It's brilliant. I mean, it actually is a really great way to...
Does it censor you?
It won't let you put all crazy stuff. Yeah, it has to censor you somehow. I didn't try
to
put...
What if you want to slander somebody?
Well, I will. You can do it. I think you can do that.
You can do it.
I didn't try, but I assume you can do it because you can put in, whatever.
Yeah, they're shoutable followed by the lawyers with actionable.
But if you want to propose to someone in New York City, say, by the way, turn around, and you could say, will you marry me? You could say, happy birthday, happy anniversary. It's a great little trick to freak out your
friends. And did you subscribe to this?
It's a free app. You download it. You get the first one is free. Then it's $4.95 each. Actually, $4.95 for five of them. So it's really $1 a person, a piece.
Wow. So you're going all over New York freaking people out.
You can, yeah. And so when you download it on the app, it shows you your location, and you have to choose which one. And, there's so many. There's one on each side of the block. I wasn't sure if it was
the
one.
Can I do the big one on Times Square?
No.
No.
That's going to cost you put a few zeros behind that
okay,
one.
Okay, fine. Okay.
You probably can, but yeah, it would be like four zeros.
I got you.
We got time for more?
Yeah, one more. Go ahead.
All right. So actually, this is not an app. This is a website. So LAX, which is one of my favorite airports. I don't know how you feel about it.
Why is that one of your favorite airports?
Because I live 10 minutes away from it. I know it inside and out.
Well, I know it inside and out too, but come on.
But the traffic is driving me nuts. But this is why you want to follow their new handle. It's called Fly LAX Airport. You follow them on Twitter, and then every 15 minutes, they'll tell you live updates of all the security lines, the traffic, up arrivals and departures. So you always want to go to arrivals usually because it's...
You want to beat them, completely reverse the process.
You go to arrivals.
When you take off, you go to arrivals, absolutely.
Yeah. Even when you're landing. Anytime. And I watch it because now I get these tweets every 15 minutes. And it's almost always 40 minutes for departures and usually 15 minutes for... arrivals.
Yeah, but there's something else here, and let's talk about it.
Okay.
You're talking about they're going to give you the app that updates the security lines at the TSA?
Well, no, this is not an app. This is their Twitter handle. It's a new Twitter handle.
Whatever it is, they're updating it, right?
Right.
Okay. Here's the problem. Who's their source of information? It's the TSA.
No, this is not the TSA. They're actually using a software, which I have written down. I don't have it right in front of me.
All right, but here's the deal. I don't trust that app, and I'll tell you why. By the time they update it, I'm still in the longest line at LAX.
If you are continuing on to another Southwest destination, please make sure that you check the monitors inside the terminal for your proper gate and flight information. If you are continuing on with another airline, we really don't care.
Let me set the stage for you. It's the middle of the summer. More people are traveling through airports this summer than ever before. The TSA has dispatched a number of their agents to the southern border, which means the lines are going to get longer and not any more pleasant. A lot of airports, even though the airlines are adding 111,000 more seats a day to handle the load, that doesn't mean the airports can handle it. And that brings me to my next guest. She is the co-founder and chairman and CEO of Clear, Karen Seidman Becker. How are you?
Good morning. Thank you.
I go back to when Clear first started, and I was one of the original, TSA PreCheck guys, and, thought it was a great idea, still do. And then all of a sudden, Clear pops up as a private enterprise trying to essentially do what TSA was doing as well. But you weren't in as many airports. It was a problem because the TSA, at least from what I understood, didn't want you there. They really weren't happy that Clear was there to begin with, at least in the early days. And then all of a sudden, it got crazy at the airports because the TSA PreCheck, while it's a great idea, the TSA, they're not business folks. They're not private sector. They're not entrepreneurial. And not enough people signed up for it as far as they were concerned. So what were they doing? They were then trying to get people who had no idea why they were being taken out of line, put in the TSA PreCheck line. These people thought they had done something wrong. They had no idea why they were doing it because TSA wanted them to sample PreCheck. These are the people who had things in their pockets since 1947. They were not helping the line, right? And then all of a sudden, Clear came back. You expanded to more airports. Next thing you know, you became a viable alternative. And I had never been a member of Clear. Because I figured, hey, I'm an original PreCheck. I'm a styling guy, and then I was asked if I wanted to sample it. I said okay, and guess what? I'll give you the most recent example. I was at the airport in Denver the other day, and the line on PreCheck was out to Brazil, and I looked at Clear, and there was no line. I said okay, I'm gonna try it as I'd become a member, and boom, they did the biometrics of my eyes, and they walked me right through. I said, this works. So walk me through, if you can, the evolution of Clear, because at one point, I mean, when you came in, Karen, they were in bankruptcy.
Yes. So, you know, you raise a lot of great points, and I'm so excited that you're a member and you're now experiencing it. But in fairness, Clear wouldn't be here without Congress and TSA talking about public-private partnership. And Clear was around before because it was an answer from Congress to 9/11 and bringing innovation through the private sector to really help both security and the customer experience. And biometrics is the unique bridge between making things safer and making things easier. I started years ago when people would be like, what's biometrics and why are you doing this? I said, it's the ATM of identity. You know, you can put multiple ATM machines in one bank teller and that scales securely and a better customer experience. And so we brought the company back in 2010, and you're right. It took us 7 years to get to the first million members, 11 and a half months to get to the next million, 8.5 months to get to the next million.
And you now have how many?
We're closing in on 4 million members.
Wow.
And the fact is that these are also individuals who represent 15 to 20 flight segments a year annually. So you're talking about not just, you know, 4 million members, but they're representing 60 and 80 million flight segments. So as a percentage of the total population.
You have frequent travelers.
We have frequent travelers. And what's been incredible is, quite frankly, PreCheck was a great step forward by TSA, just like global entry from CBP, using innovation and really starting to think about security in a different way, risk-based security. And so Clear is not an alternative. It's integrated, and it's making the customer experience even more secure because now you're putting people in who are getting different screening, and you can definitively verify their identity. But the other important point about Clear that you're really starting to see, and I think the reason why I was mapping this out yesterday, it took us 6 years to get to 12 airports. We're now at 30, and we'll end this year at over 35. And those are mostly Category X airports. And
what is a Category X airport?
A Category X airport is an airport that is, we say, in the top 30 or 40 airports of the U.S., which have a disproportionate amount. You might know the percentages better than me, but I think it's like 75 to 80% of the traffic goes through about the top 40 airports.
By the way, the definition of a great airport is the one you don't remember. I just thought I'd mention that. But let me ask you a question.
Airports are better than ever.
Well, you and I can have a long talk about that. Everything being relative, yes, they are. They still have a long way to go. Now, let's take a look at LaGuardia, for example.
Okay, yes.
Here they are rebuilding LaGuardia on the same footprint because they can't expand it. I mean, that's just the way it is.
Yeah.
And is it a convenient airport to New Yorkers? You bet. When they finish this project, right, in 2021, by the time they finish it, it'll be a brand new, gleaming, congested airport.
So, look, that is accurate, and that is the issue. I'm a little obsessed with airports. In this day and age, so a little story I was just sharing. I think there were 70 million people who watched MASH on the last night, and Now people talk about Game of Thrones at 20 million, right? The world has fragmented. Airports today have to be 2.75 million plus people are going through essentially these top 40 airports every single day. It is the place where people congregate. And you're right. If you add a few percentage to travel, it's 7.5 million individuals coming through airports and the same real estate. So innovation has to be a number one solution to drive traffic through safer.
Within the same footprint.
And easier. Innovation, not just biometrics, but innovation across the board has to be a number one solution to make it safer and easier. You can't have thousands of people congregating in any one area. That is not safe. You have to keep traffic flowing. And travel's never been easier because, you know, there's Airbnb, there's your cell phone. You could book a trip from here to California with a place to stay and a show to watch and how to get there in less than 5 minutes. I remember the days of Eastern Airlines. My mom would be on the phone for hours.
Although, I'm a big fan of the middle ground. You're right. You can book all that stuff in the span of about 4 minutes with one problem.
Traveling.
You're not having a conversation with anybody.
Well,
I'm a big fan of the conversation like we're having right now.
Yes, which is why we have 1,800 ambassadors today at the airport to bring technology to life. I think you're exactly right. Yeah. We need to use people to bring the customer experience to life along with innovation. You can't just automate the whole thing and have, you know, nobody there.
Anytime a hotel tells me or an airline tells me they've added more kiosks to the airport, I try to go to another hotel because they take away my opportunity to talk to somebody.
I agree. But I think technology and people are really the sweet solution because It has to bring it to life. Again, in the world of privacy and driving trust and data security, you need people to explain to you what you're doing and what you're partaking in and what it means and what's done with your data. So we, you know, as much as people love our technology, they tell us what they love more are our people.
Oh, absolutely. Because look, when I was at Denver the other day, it wasn't just going up to the machine and have my eyes read. Somebody literally talked to me and then walked me to the front of the line, which, by the way, there was no line. Yay. But you talk about a private-public partnership between CLEAR and TSA. I happen to think you guys win by default, because when the TSA is closing checkpoints, when the TSA is not properly staffing those checkpoints, you win because you're open.
I think travelers win. Yeah. And that's a really important point, which is we're obsessed with the traveler experience and the customer experience. As we talked about when I came in here this morning, I'm a scared flyer and I fly a lot. And so the stress of flying, of leaving my family, the stress of traveling with my family.
Then I have a new program for you. It's called Sedated. You have CLEAR and you have Sedated. Well, I'll give you the Sedated line. Right?
So I think that making travel easier and safer and working in partnership with the government is never been more important, and there's never been a bigger opportunity. It's an exciting moment in travel and innovation.
Is there an airport you want to get into right now that you haven't gotten into?
Oh, yes.
Like? Come on.
Newark, Chicago, San Diego, Tampa, Oakland. We'd like to expand at Miami and DFW. Unfortunately, we're not ubiquitous in those airports, which those travelers find unacceptable. We're ubiquitous now in Fort Lauderdale, and it's incredible.
You've always been in Orlando.
Yes, we love Orlando. CLEAR would not be in business without Orlando. The Orlando airport, under that leadership, cared about innovation and the customer experience and security and partnership, and they put us into business.
The thing that turned me around on CLEAR was Orlando, because I wasn't there to see Mickey. Okay, I wasn't there to see Mickey, and everybody else was, but by going through CLEAR, I bypassed that.
The largest percentage of first-time travelers are at the Orlando airport.
Really?
And interesting. If you didn't know that, that's exciting that
thank you for sharing.
A statistic.
Absolutely. But one of the things that's important for everybody listening to this show is, you know, it's one thing if you want to join TSA PreCheck. You have to join CLEAR separately, right?
Yes.
And then how long does the membership last?
We have an annual membership. But what we also offer, again, in the world of great consumer experiences, Netflix, Amazon Prime, there's a free one-month trial where your credit card is never charged, because seeing is believing. And you really want – innovation is about bringing people what they did not know they wanted. People do not wake up and say, I got to get myself some biometric security, biometric identity this morning. So there's two parts. Number one is free trials. And number two is adding different nodes to the network. So now you can use your face to drive off the lot at Hertz.
Okay, you got me going. You had me at the airport. Okay, we got that. What are you doing at sports stadiums?
So sports stadiums, people, you know, 48,000 people come to a baseball game. That looks like an airport from just a volume perspective. And 50% of the population or the fans come within 30 minutes of game time. So when you think about getting fans in efficiently and securely and caring about the customer experience and security, biometrics, your face is your ticket, a pre-check for sports stadiums, and then the ability to use it in new places. So we've launched biometric beer with the Mariners, and you are your driver's license, you are your credit card, at the tap of a finger you get a beer. And so having that whole
at the tap of a finger. How do they cut you off? How do they know when you've had too many? They look back in your eyes? Biometric drunks?
We're starting with identity and we'll move on from there. And so and what we've really realized is sports stadiums, airports, Hertz locations, buildings, they're part of, people talk about smart cities, they're ecosystems. If you're going to LaGuardia, you're also going to a Knicks or a concert or a baseball game. And so using biometrics to make things safer and easier in many different areas also helps adoption, and it's helped stickiness. So people love it at sports stadiums where it's fast lane through, and then we've partnered with Major League Baseball where your biometrics are your ticket. You can use it out at Citi Field. It's the same thing as the biometric boarding pass that we have with Delta.
So it's linked to your credit card too.
It is linked to your credit card, because when you enroll in CLEAR, you become your wallet. You become your driver's license. You become your credit card. They merge with you. And so on your driver's license is your age. And so you can use it, again, age validation, payment, ticketing. And so, you know, when you fly with Delta, when you put your fingerprints down, you are your driver's license and your boarding pass. It's the same thing.
I see the little clear things at the Delta check-in, even at their crown, I call it the Crown Club, their Sky Club now.
That's right.
But here's the thing. Have you done the research to show me on those lines at the sports stadiums how fast the clearance is now?
So what we know is that you get into stadiums with less than a 5-minute average. Usually it's a lot less than that, but what you can do then is have a predictable experience. Leave your office for a 12 o'clock game or, you know, a 12 o'clock Saturday game and get there at 11:55.
No, leave your office for a 12 o'clock Friday game. Maybe they won't miss you.
But so what it is about consistency and predictability. Whether there's no line or a long line, it's about consistency and predictability and customer experience for secure entry.
Now, if I'm a member of the Hertz Number One Club, for example, and I'm part of Clear, what does that do for me in the rental car experience?
So we are at about 9 or 10 Hertz locations now and should double that by end of year. There's a Hertz Fast Lane out, where as opposed to rolling down your window and showing someone your documents and your driver's license to drive off the lot. And it's that same bank problem that you have at the airport, which is everyone's driving off the lot at 7 a.m. There can be a long line to exit. You look in the camera, a pod, which is Hertz powered by Clear, and your face is your Hertz Gold account, and it opens the arm and you drive off the lot. So again, it's that automated, secure experience.
Okay, now where do you think you're going to expand this? Okay, you've already got Clear, you got the sports stadiums, you got the airports, right?
Yes.
Next?
Well, we want to continue to drive curb to gate in airports. So biometric bag drop is a really big deal. And again, when you think of eliminating those lines to drop your bag, you put your fingerprints down at a pod, put out your bag tag, put it on and have your bag screened. That's something that we have piloted in Minneapolis, and we think there's big opportunities there. So when you think of that curb to gate, you think of biometric payment and age validation in the concessions area post security at airports. You should not have to take out your wallet in airports. So more airports, curb to gate in airports, sports stadiums, entry to seat. We think that there's more opportunities when you think about building access, right? I came in here today without my driver's license. So how do you get in?
You had to know somebody. That would be me.
I used my global entry card, actually. Right. But why are we walking around with all these cards in our wallets? We are them. And I think that healthcare is another huge opportunity. I'm mesmerized by the fact that a plastic ID card with no picture on it, that you get a new one every 6 months and you can't remember which one it is, represents all of your healthcare, both coverage and records.
Right, your
it's
medical
crazy.
History.
Your it's
medical
crazy.
History. Devil's advocate question. I remember when PreCheck started, there were no lines. It was great. What about Clear? At what point do you reach the point of diminishing returns where there are lines at Clear?
That's a really important point, and we are very focused on data and how we're doing from a verification per minute, per second, volume numbers. We are looking at all of our data real time to make sure that we're scaling, adding more pods and people. But in some airports today, we are more than 10% of the volume going through airports on less than 5% of the real estate. And so we do think that it's easy pass and cash lanes, right? There used to be one easy pass lane and more cash lanes. And we think it's very important that we continue to partner with airports to make sure that we can add lanes, which creates opportunities for the airports. We are partnered with airports both from a revenue perspective, you know, which is really important that they're monetizing real estate that otherwise they weren't, and they can use that for other opportunities to improve their airports.
But speaking of real estate, I mean, the sad fact is we haven't had a new airport in this country since Denver. That was more than 25 years ago. So you're not expanding space. You just got to deal with the space you've been given.
But you've got to use it more efficiently. And what we've proven through studies is that you can lift efficiency through innovation by over 30%. And so I think there's huge opportunities to continue to drive efficiency, security, and throughput.
And your biggest challenge?
Oh, so many.
We have time.
So, you know, at first it was proving to people that biometrics were the future. Then it was proving to people that the company, which was bankrupt, could be a sustainable business. And then it was proving to people that you could effectively partner with the government. And I think we've done all of those things, and we're really grateful for our team and the partnership.
Riding along in my automobile, my baby beside me at the wheel, cruising and playing the radio, with no particular place to go.
Audible.com has more than 150,000 titles and virtually every genre. So check it out for yourself. Sign up today at www.audiblepodcast.com/travel today to get a free audiobook and 30-day trial.
Joining me now is the president and CEO of CLIA, stands for the Cruise Lines International Association, Kelly Craighead. Kelly,
the cruise industry has a role to play in these meetings as well, simply because you've had such unprecedented growth in the last, 3 years?
Absolutely. Well, first, thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be part of IPW, in part because, the U.S. has been a great market for the cruise industry. We have enjoyed unprecedented growth, but the industry is still really pretty small. So last year, 28.5 million people took a cruise. This year, we expect 30 million will take a cruise. That spend is about $140 billion a year. And so there's just huge potential to do even more in the impact for destinations that we travel to, for our passengers and the people in the destinations we visit is huge.
If I go back, 10 years ago, there might have been 500 ports, maybe 500, that your ships called upon all around the world. Now it's over, 1,200?
Yes, it's over 1,200. And what's been exciting about the industry is that it's growing in all market segments. And in fact, for millennials, there's huge appetite for cruising. And you see that in the ships that are coming online with 118 ships expected between now and 2027, with a huge kind of swing between the size. So many smaller ships that are going to newer destinations and bigger ships that are going to some of the tried and true marquee lands.
And what's interesting to me in the hotel business, I talked about this earlier with Roger, you see major brand retail operations now coming up with their own brand of hotels. Shinola, Restoration Hardware, Equinox, Nobu, and the list goes on. It's now happening in the cruise industry. You have Virgin and you have Ritz-Carlton, and neither of which had a cruise line before.
That's right. So not only are there new entrants into the market, which I think will really just grow the size of the pie, since there's so much opportunity, even within ships themselves, there are new and different brands. So I was recently on the Celebrity Edge. They have an entire concierge floor that is a club within the ship.
Oh, that was the floor they wouldn't let me in. I remember that, yeah.
Well, it is discerning. They have a discerning
Thank you so much, yes, yes. No, but when you have those kind of brands, and they're trying to, Virgin is not going after the world cruise market. They're going after a much younger demo.
Well, I had the great fortune to be with Sir Richard Branson recently. They're going for a young, at heart, clientele. And so they really do have a theory of change around kind of what they can bring to the cruise market that does appeal to a younger audience, to be sure. They'll have tattoo parlors and just a host of ideas.
Wait, stop right there. Tattoo parlors?
Absolutely. So they think 25%.
I was drunk on a cruise. I didn't know.
So 25% apparently of people have tattoos, so they really recognize it as an area of interest for their passengers. And so that'll be one of their unique offerings.
I bet they're going to make you sign a waiver. Are you completely sure that you're not drunk when you're signing? Unbelievable. Okay.
Well, what happens on a cruise ship stays on a cruise ship.
Apparently it does. And then Ritz-Carlton going for a different demo altogether.
Right. So you really do see the luxury vertical expanding in quite dramatic ways. I think as travelers are becoming more interested in experiences, whether it's a brand like Azamara or like Ritz-Carlton, where they do offer the opportunity to take a cruise, but also to get off and stay on shore for a day or multiple days, really just demonstrates the variety of offerings that are coming online.
Call me old school. I'm a big fan of days at sea. I'm a big fan of days in port. I'm not a big fan of seven ports in 7 days.
Well, here's the great news. What I've learned since taking this position in January is there is a cruise for everybody. So if you are somebody who enjoys long, leisurely days at sea, there's an itinerary for you. If you like the convenience of being able to be efficient in your travel, see multiple destinations in one trip but only unpack one time, there's an option for you. So young, old, long cruises, short cruises, near destinations, far destinations, there's a product.
But in order for the cruise lines to change their model, if you will, for spending more time in ports, that's been their real challenge because the ports want them out. Those ports want turnaround. They want turnaround. They want turnaround. And the ships thought in the old model want to turn around too because they made money at sea. They didn't make money in the port.
Right. Well, I think you're seeing a real evolution in both ports and in cruise ships. And there are several ports that want to be developed and are looking to attract cruise ships, and where we're working in partnership with ports to really have a quick turnaround.
Talking to Kelly Craighead, the CEO and president of Cruise Lines International. How many different companies do you represent?
We have over 50 global cruise lines. Our membership, though, is much broader than the cruise lines. We also work, we have marketing affiliates with riverboats. We have tens of thousands of travel agents and hundreds of suppliers, so shipyards, shipbuilders, ports, destinations, so really the whole ecosystem of cruise.
You know, you mentioned river cruises. They've had an explosive growth. I mean, unbelievable so, right? The only thing that's limiting them is water levels on some rivers.
Right, but that is, you know, I think last year was an extreme year. It's an amazing product that is kind of just exploding. You're exactly right. But the water levels is a challenge for how they're driving the meeting the demand, given just the unpredictability of that.
I'm interested to see the challenges in that particular part of the business, because at a certain point they're going to run out of rivers, and at a certain point they're going to run out of places they can dock. Because in the old days with the river cruises, maybe 6 years ago, you know, you'd just open a small little landing in a small little town in Germany, and you were it with only 118 passengers, and you just walked off and walked around the town and saw things and interacted with the people. On many of those routes today, when you pull up to that small landing, you're now lashed to five other ships because they're all there at the same time.
Right, that's true. But I do think you're seeing a lot of innovation, just like in ocean-going vessels. We're seeing it in riverboats. Lots of exploration around different forms of power, some being battery-powered and that are being invested in and sought after.
We're talking about hybrids?
Yeah.
Really?
Yes, absolutely. And so I do think that's going to create more opportunities. I don't think we'll run out of rivers. I think across the travel and tourism landscape, we have to expand the destination offerings. I think with some of these kind of innovative new river boats, they will be in a much kind of better position to explore new rivers and to really kind of continue growing outside of those most impacted areas.
I'm thinking that maybe they're just going to have to redefine the seasons, because I'm a big fan of like getting rid of seasonality altogether. I don't mind, you know, doing the Volga in December, because
right.
You get a chance to see the country.
Right. I agree. I mean, I do think that there is a benefit to changing the seasons and to kind of increasing awareness. You know, I grew up in California, traveled to the Caribbean is a big destination for us. But I'm equally excited about seeing the Christmas markets in winter, which is not a prime season for U.S. travelers. And so I do think you have a great point about changing the seasons and for us to expand the offerings.
I'm getting to the point where I'm thinking that the old days of repositioning cruises, where they had to move the ship to chase the season, is going to start diminishing. They can keep ships in certain markets as long as they can expand the season.
I think you're right about that. And I do think that there is
although I should tell you, I like nothing better than a repositioning cruise.
I was just going to say, there is just a host of people who seek out repositioning. And
for those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, a repositioning cruise can be as long as 45 days.
Yes.
I mean, I saw a trip last year from Barcelona to New Orleans. That was, I think, 39 days on Carnival. And of those 39 days, 31 of those days you were at sea.
Yep, absolutely.
How great is that?
Nobody
well, able to,
say, to
find you.
In my family, the biggest cruise lover is my Aunt Susan, who loves nothing more than a repositioning cruise, who literally took a cruise from Sydney to L.A. I think it was 45 days itself. She had an amazing time.
And, of course, there's freighter cruising, which you guys don't really get involved in that much.
No.
But that's another way to go. Bring a lot of books. But, there's no Broadway show tunes that night, unless you're singing.
Well, no one wants to hear that.
As I just said, there are no Broadway show tunes. But if you can find a good repositioning cruise, the value is unbelievable, because we worked it out on that repositioning cruise, that 39-day cruise, the cabin was like $62 a night.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's. I have to say, one of the things that is so incredible about cruising is the value, which doesn't always mean bargain. It just means your currency, dollar for us, goes so much further. I've heard stories of an around-the-world cruise for $110 a day. I mean, that is unbelievable.
You cannot wake up in Cleveland for $110
You could not. So there really is just great value. So there are terrific bargains if you want. But again, it's just the variety of the product that has something for everybody.
And of your members, how many new ships this year?
We have 18 new ships this year.
Every shipyard's full.
and every shipyard is full. I mean, I think one of the exciting, you know, again, it's important to recognize that it's still a relatively small industry. But if you look at the order books in shipyards alone, there's just huge, huge opportunity and upside. And they're saturated now. So you can see that there is this growing demand for cruising.
And they're building ships of every size and pedigree.
And for us, we've seen a huge growth in the expedition ship category and in the large ships.
In the luxury expedition ship category.
Absolutely.
That's right. Galapagos with butlers. That's the only way I'm going. That's it.
Hello and welcome to Alaska Flight 438. We'd like to tell you now about some important safety features of this aircraft. The most important safety feature we have aboard this plane is the flight attendants. Please look at one now.
Joining me now, a regular on our show. I've known him for so many years. He's always right on the money when it comes to listing, talking, explaining the problems as well as the progress in the aviation industry. He's the head of the Boyd Aviation Group, our friend in Colorado, Mike Boyd. How are you, sir?
Good day, sir. I'm doing just great, and you too, I hope.
I am. I want to talk about a little bit of history here and how history may be repeating itself. And I go back to the worst aviation disaster in American history, which is American Airlines Flight 191, 40 years ago, by the way, in Chicago on the Friday of Memorial Day weekend back in 1979. And for those people who don't remember it, it was an American Airlines DC-10 rolling down the runway headed for Los Angeles, full load of passengers, when just after it took off, I mean, literally after the wheels left the ground, the left engine inexplicably literally ripped itself from the wings and flew from the plane. The plane became uncontrollable, basically asymmetrical. It almost inverted, crashed into an explosive fireball. Everybody died. And the reason why I'm bringing that up is because of some of the parallels that may actually be there in the post-crash investigations of both of the Boeing 737 MAX planes. And let me just give you the preface here, Michael, and then we'll talk about it. In that investigation of the DC-10, they found out that the plane itself was not unsafe. It was the maintenance. And the maintenance was that American Airlines felt they could save 4 hours per engine change when the planes were brought in for maintenance by using a forklift truck to lift up the engine, when the maintenance manual from the manufacturer itself said, in no uncertain terms, do not use a forklift truck because it might lose pressure. American intentionally ignored it. And in fact, they told the FAA they were going to ignore it, and the FAA didn't do anything about it. And on this particular aircraft, they were performing a left engine change. They had the engine up on the forklift truck. The engine is fastened by four bolts. Two of the bolts were in when the lunch whistle blew, and everybody went to lunch. And during lunch, the forklift lost pressure. The weight of that engine on the two bolts was too much. It broke one of the bolts, bent the other. The guys came back from lunch, put in the remaining two bolts without realizing the damage to the first two. The plane then flies empty to Chicago, then takes on a full load of passengers and fuel, and the rest is history. Now let's move 40 years ahead to the Lion Air crash in Indonesia and the Ethiopian Air crash, the two of the Boeing 737 MAX jets. In the DC-10 case, there was intense lobbying by the manufacturer and by the airlines involved, I'll explain what I mean by airlines involved, not to ground that plane. And the FAA had to be dragged kicking and screaming into finally grounding the plane, but for all the wrong reasons. Here in the Boeing 737, what do we see? Intense lobbying by the manufacturer, by the airlines involved, getting what? At the FAA to please not ground the plane. And in fact, the FAA was the last agency around the world to ground the plane. Are there parallels? What do you think, Mike?
Well, I think we need to be careful here. One was sloppy maintenance just to save money. And in this case, there are a lot of other things going on here. Keep in mind, people who I trust, the Allied Pilots Association, Southwest Airlines Pilots Association, and ALPA, they all said this airplane could be flown safely. I would take that to the bank. There's other things that we've missed here. Keep in mind that Ethiopian airplane had only a single pilot in the cockpit. The co-pilot was effectively a seat warmer with 200 hours in type. Shouldn't have been there. So there's a lot of things there, but your point of the FAA letting things go, that should not be ignored, Peter. This has happened for years, and many people in the FAA have become possibly too close to the manufacturers, too close to the airlines. And we got to be I've had experience with that, with the FAA, you know, maybe not wanting to, you know, they find something wrong and maybe saying, I don't want to, you know, implicate myself in letting it happen. So your point should not be ignored, regardless of any other facts in the matter.
Well, you know, it's one thing. I'll give you a for instance. It's just a hypothetical. But let's say I'm holding a pen with two fingers. And for whatever reason, we don't know why, the pen drops from my hand and there's an accident. Now we investigate. What was the probable cause? And we don't know. That's fair enough. That's what the NTSB does. They do incredible work under incredible odds and conditions to come up with the probable cause. But in many cases, what the NTSB does is they not only give you the probable cause, they can tell you the solution. And in many cases, that solution can be implemented. So in the case of my pen, we investigate, and what we find out is that you really need to hold the pen with three fingers. So we report the reason for the crash was it was only being held by two fingers, and we need to do three fingers. Well, if the Federal Pen Agency, which is the agency regarding safety of pens, hears that information and knows that the third finger is available, no pun intended, and then chooses to not make that rule, that, in my mind, borders on criminal negligence. They know the problem, they know the solution, and they make a conscious choice to side with economic impact on pen manufacturers as opposed to the ink, let's say.
That is not necessarily invalid, I don't think. But I wonder if it's as clear as that. You know, you get a situation where they look and make a determination. In this case, for example, like I said, people who I trust, these airlines pilots unions, which are not toadies for the company, when they say the airplane could be flown safely, I will take it with that. And keep in mind, with Lion Air, that's an airline that has major safety background problems. And like I said, Ethiopian had unqualified cockpit crew in it. So
right.
It's more than just what you brought up. But we shouldn't let those factors I just mentioned smokescreen the situation where where the FAA may be not showing the kind of oversight it needs to. It's there. I know it's there. There are a lot of good people in the FAA, Peter.
Sure.
Very good people. Very often the people put in at the top are incompetent and shouldn't be there. We found that out at 9/11. But the fact of the matter is there pressure to let it go? And also, they're dealing with engineers who they trust. And
right.
It gets very, very foggy here. So I think it's a situation that no matter what the causes or whatever these two crashes, we're going to be better off because all the things you brought up, you know, they have not been missed by other people. They have not been missed by Boeing, have not been missed by the FAA. So it will be better going forward. This is not going to be something that's going to be just an accident we just let go.
Oh, I agree with you on that. Look, the 737 itself is a 50-year-old airframe. It's proven itself. It's the most reliable, most widely used jet in the air today. I fly it all the time. I think what the pilots are saying is that, yes, you can fly this plane. It just has a really bad flight management system that has to be fixed. In the process, though, of the intense lobbying to the FAA not to ground the plane and the intense lobbying by Boeing to say the plane is totally safe, what they've done in the process through their, I have no other words to use other than arrogance, is to create a situation where now the brand needs serious rehabilitation because
absolutely.
the most recent surveys that I, by the way, believe are saying that an overwhelming majority of passengers say they don't want to fly the plane now.
And I think a lot of that, you're so right. You're on the money.
The thing is, it's a totally flyable plane. I'd get on it tomorrow as long as that flight management system is fixed. However, nobody wants to fix it fast. The FAA has some serious credibility problems, not to mention some trust problems now. Other government agencies are saying publicly that they're not going to depend on the FAA to say that the plane's been recertified. They want to do it themselves. And what that means, of course, is for every airline that tells you this plane is going to be flying by summer, I think they're delusional.
I think politically so. Now, and the other thing is, there's a lot of very bad reporting on this. The Denver Post and others came out with a report that said that Boeing had warned airlines that the MAX 8 couldn't fly in certain airports, making it look like it's a dangerous airplane. They were referring to a trade dispute where Boeing came out and said the 700 can fly places the 800 can't because it's a shorter, smaller airplane, like Daocheng, China, where it's 14,000. But they reported as if the reason was there's a safety problem with it. And that was in the Denver Post, which I wouldn't line a birdcage with. But that kind of reporting does factor in here, and Boeing has to deal with that, and I don't think they have.
No, they haven't. They've not gotten ahead of the story. Look, there is a certain sense of piling on here, but at the same time, I think that Boeing brought that upon itself by not realizing the extent of the optics here. Mike, as we're talking about brand rehab here, no shortage of connotations about what that means for the 737. As we're talking, you and I both know that Boeing is in their crisis management mode now, trying to figure out, okay, assuming we get certified or recertified, and I think that's going to happen, assuming that happens, who's going to be the first public figure to fly the plane? So I'm sure they're going to have airline CEOs fly it. I'm sure they're going to try to get some celebrities to fly it. I get that. At the same time, you have President Trump tweeting that maybe Boeing should change the name of the plane, which I think is absurd because that would mean that they have something to hide. What do you think is going to happen?
No, I really don't think it's absurd. I mean, this is not a Tylenol thing. I think what you do is you make some major changes to the airplane. It's something, and call it the Ultra, but get the name Max out of it because that has been badly besmirched over the years. And just say, look, we brought this airplane out, and we've done other things to it, demonstrable things to it, and say this is a next-generation airplane. But keep in mind, you brought it up. This is a 50-year-old airplane in terms of design. I mean, the first 737-100 and this airplane are, you know, eons apart. But the fact of the matter is, it's an airplane. The tube was designed in the 1950s for the Boeing 707. So it is proven, but the point is, I think the name Max should be retired pretty damn quickly because it does have a bad connotation. Now, Tylenol got away with it. I don't know, maybe Boeing can too.
Well, Tylenol got away with it because the chairman of Tylenol really got ahead of the story and did all the proactive things you need to do when confronted with tampering. Boeing didn't.
Yes.
And so I don't think you recover from that once it happens. I think you're right. You may have to change part of the name, but you're not going to call it like Better Than Max or Max Plus. what are you going to call it? Because it'll be the source of late night comedians' jokes for a while, as bad taste as that may seem. And the public needs to feel confident enough that they can fly it. And I say this, by the way, having already said I would get on that plane tomorrow as long as they fix the management system of the plane, because the plane itself, when you think about it, has the same flight management system, basically, that the other models have as well.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of confusing reporting about it. And again, like I said, if Allied Pilots Association and American says the airplane is safe, I'm getting on it. But the problem is, in the rest of the world, we have issues, and now we have political issues. I mean, China's you know stretching its muscle to say, look at this, we shut it down. I think overall, the bottom line of it is, once they get this thing fixed addressed, we kind of put it behind us. We don't keep bringing it up. We put it behind us and move on. But I'm not so sure that it might not be a good idea to do something else to the airplane. I mean, I don't know, whatever it is, some design change on it.
I have a wonderful design change for the plane. It has nothing to do with safety. It is, have you been in the lavatory of a 737 MAX?
Yes, and I brought my Acrobat suit, and it worked fine.
I'm telling you, it is physically, I'm not making this up, I'm not exaggerating, I'm not having fun with this, I'm telling you a fact. It is physically impossible, unless, as Michael suggests, you're a member of the cast of Cirque du Soleil, for you to go in that lavatory and actually wash both hands in the sink at the same time.
Well, the sink's at least 3 inches wide, Peter, something like that.
It's unbelievable.
It really is, and I think this is one of the things airlines have forgotten, and they've not all forgotten it, but, you know, it's like the president of United said, literally, he said, quote, our passengers are pissed when they sit down. Well, Oscar, there's a reason for that, okay? And it's not just the airport and the baggage claim area.
By the way, Mike, I got to tell you this. You're going to love this story. Scott McCartney, our good friend who's also on the show a lot from the Wall Street Journal, did a piece, we talked about it on the air, where he invited the three CEOs of American, United, and Delta to come out to the airports where they're based and actually fly in coach and tell us what you think about it. And American did it, Delta did it, and United declined. There you go.
Yeah, I you got to get along with people, and they all say they're trying, but when some airlines have a system where literally people are forced or implied forced to line up an hour ahead of time at a gate area to get the overhead space, those systems need to be taken away. But that's the problem. Airlines, we got to get our people on airplanes quickly. This is not a cattle barn.
Right.
Or off into it. If you can't fly into Denver because of a snowstorm like today or a few days ago, you can change your trip, but you can't refund your ticket. I got a problem.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We're at sort of a crisis point now, a threshold moment of definition. Are the airlines in the travel and transportation business or the human cargo business? And until we come up with a satisfactory answer to that question, and hopefully it's not the latter, we're going to have a problem.
Well, I think it's been answered now. It is the latter. It's moving people A to B as quickly as we can, rather than getting them to their destination with a smile on their face. That's all that matters. We deal with airport design. We tell people the airport that's good is the one you don't remember. And that's a really good airport, you know. So same thing with air travel.
I love that line. I'm writing that line down. The airport that's good is the one you won't remember. Talk about branding.
You've been listening to Peter Greenberg Worldwide. Catch us each week as we broadcast from a new location somewhere around the world.